From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we'll start the hour again in Iran, where a stampede during a funeral procession for General Qasem Soleimani left dozens of mourners dead. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reiterated today that the U.S. will abide by the laws of war if it retaliates to any retaliation by Iran. He was asked about President Trump's threats to attack Iranian cultural sites. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and joins us now once again. Mary Louise, let's start with the stampede. What more can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's an awful event. What we have are reports from Iranian news agencies of several dozen people, it sounds like, who were killed in the stampede. This was in the city of Kerman, which is a big city in southeastern Iran, about 500 miles from the capital, Tehran, where I'm speaking to you from. And it is the hometown of Qasem Soleimani. So the body has been making its way through cities in Iraq and now Iran these last several days. This was to be the last procession where mourners could come out and mourn him, and then he was to be buried today. Obviously, events got out of control there.
You sat down today with the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said to you.
This was an act of aggression, an armed attack, albeit a cowardly armed attack, against an Iranian official in foreign territory. It amounts to war, and we will respond according to our own timing and choice.
It amounts to war, and we'll respond according to our own timing and choice. What did he tell you about the options Iran is considering for a response to the killing of Soleimani?
Well, that was exactly the question I was trying to pin him down on, as you can imagine. And you will be stunned to hear he did not telegraph to me exactly what Iran's next move will be. He was very clear, as you got a sense from there, that there will be retaliation. There will be revenge. He spoke about how people's feelings here are hurt and the outrage here. And you could hear it. Soleimani was a close personal friend of his. And you could hear that the determination that this country will act. What exactly they will do, when exactly they will do it, he wouldn't go there. He said they will respond at a time and place of their choosing. I will say, we heard from a different top official here today. This is a man named Ali Shamkhani. He's the top official on Iran's answer to the national security, their National Security Council. And according to Iranian media, he has said they are considering 13 specific options for retaliation, which means journalists are now scrambling to try to figure out what those 13 are.
Mm-hmm. What about the nuclear deal? We heard Iran say in the last couple of days that they're not going to be complying with the main parts of it, but it sounds like they may be willing to come back to the nuclear deal at some later point. Can you tell us more about what Zarif said about the nuclear deal?
Sure. And this is also personal to Zarif. It's worth noting. He is the one who negotiated it on behalf of Iran back in 2015 when it was John Kerry at the State Department. It was the two of them who sat down and really hashed this out. I asked him today point blank, is the nuclear deal dead? He conceded it is not good news for the deal. He said specifically, going forward, we will cease compliance with the limits laid out in the deal in terms of centrifuges. But as you noted, he was emphasizing they are suspending compliance, not cutting it off for forever. He said, should circumstances change, should Europe, which is still party to the nuclear deal, find a way to ease the sanctions that Iran has come under, that they may well find their way back into full compliance and that international inspectors will still be allowed into Iran. So that's another not good news, but watch the space for what exactly Iran decides to do and what their next action is.
Finally, Mary Louise, we spoke with you a day ago. What has changed in the last 24 hours as both the United States and Iran worry about the possibility of war?
Well, I'll speak to just what it feels like here. It's a normal day. Yesterday, most people were off work because they wanted to observe here in Tehran the procession of Soleimani's casket through the streets and the funeral services that were held at Tehran University. And many, many hundreds of thousands, perhaps more than a million people turned out for that. So that was a very different feeling. Today, you see people out buying bread, going to work. You asked me yesterday, does this feel like a country on war footing? And the answer is Yes and no. People are out taking their kids to school. I saw somebody walking his dog down the street this morning. Life continues, as you would imagine. And yet, he's walking his dog underneath this huge billboard that's showing Soleimani's portrait and is describing Soleimani as a martyr and saying retaliation is coming. So that's what it feels like to be in Tehran right now.
That's NPR's Mary Louise Kelly joining us from Tehran. Mary Louise, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
More than a million Iranian Americans live in the United States, and many have family still living back in Iran. There are lots of concerns and fears of a war in their home country after last week's killing of Qassem Soleimani. Asel Rod is a research fellow for the National Iranian American Council in the United States, and she joins us on Skype from Irvine, California. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So you were born in the U.S., but most of your extended family actually lives in Iran, and you've had a chance to talk with them since General Soleimani's death. What have they been sharing with you?
A lot of what they've been sharing is feelings of fear, feelings of sort of anxiousness, not really knowing what the next steps are. But another thing that was very important, and a lot of them have highlighted, is that now, after this event, you know, there were protests in Iran less than two months ago. And those protests were targeted against their own government. And a lot of them keep highlighting the fact that now it's like those protests have died. And there's really this event in many ways is being seen as a strong blow to their national pride. And so it's having this sort of rallying effect where even people who don't like the regime still find a problem with this because it undermines Iranian sovereignty and because this particular figure is someone who is seen as a protector of the borders because his particular role in the Quds force was to focus on external Iranian foreign policy, not domestic. You know, a lot of commentary, for instance, is people saying things like, if it wasn't for Soleimani, then ISIS would be in Iran. So I think more than anything else, the feeling that I'm getting from them is concern for what is to come.
Yes. You mentioned those protests that happened over the hike in gas prices and the struggling economy. Amnesty International reported that more than 300 protesters were killed in a crackdown. Can you talk a little bit more deeply about what Soleimani's killing has meant for those anti-government protests moving forward?
Well, it's extinguished them completely. I mean, the government physically cracking down on a protest doesn't mean that the sentiment behind the protest is gone. But now in many ways, that sentiment and this is, of course, not for all. There's still many, many Iranians who have extreme discontent with the government, would like to see the government be changed. But that's not necessarily a majority opinion. But even and I would argue that the majority opinion in Iran is that they're completely dissatisfied with their government because of its corruption, mismanagement, and because they find themselves in a very difficult, more than anything else, economic situation. That, of course, was exacerbated by U.S. actions, by the Trump administration quitting the Iran deal, levying sanctions. But really, this event sort of changed the whole narrative because now, and this has been something that people like myself, people who have studied Iran and are, you know, analysts have been trying to say is, while we're looking at the situation as, well, they have a discontent with their own government, so if we put enough pressure, you know, they'll then put pressure on their own government. There's also, you know, I mean, it's still a nation state. They still have national pride. And especially when it comes to foreign aggression, that was always the concern, that the more aggressive we become, the more we're going to help unite them. And actually against us. And that's precisely what happened with this action.
I want to ask you about some things that we've seen here in the United States and also at some of the borders. We're learning that dozens of Iranians and Iranian Americans were held for hours at the Washington state border with Canada over the weekend after the Department of Homeland Security ramped up security at borders. And some folks were reportedly held and questioned for up to 10 hours. This is extremely troubling to you.
Yes, it's extremely troubling because, you know, it's sort of this moment where you feel like your Americanness, being an American, is being almost questioned. And that's because of the nature of the questions that are being asked, right? There were people who were reporting that the questions that they're asked are about the political situation, which seems wildly inappropriate to ask, you know, an American person who's an American citizen who's just coming back to their country, how they feel about a political situation, about their country of heritage. But what's troubling is to think what effect any kind of conflict would now have on us here, because we have this precedent in U.S. history when you look at World War II and Japanese internment. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to jump the gun. I don't want to exaggerate the events that have taken place. But, you know, there's certainly those types of comments occurring within the community right now. And whether those are an exaggeration or not, it highlights the fact that something is wrong if there are Americans who are feeling vulnerable and insecure in their own country.
Asal Raad, research fellow for the National Iranian American Council in the United States. Asal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning, and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed. And now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First to start your weekend from NPR News.
In Washington today, tensions with Iran are overshadowing President Trump's impeachment trial, which, when it starts, would become only the third such trial in U.S. history. Let's get some historical perspective from Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're on the brink of an impeachment trial and on the brink, possibly, of war with Iran. Can you think of any moment like this before in U.S. history?
Well, it sure brings back some memories of the impeachment of Bill Clinton when the House was getting ready to vote on the articles. He launches missile strikes at Iraq, and you had split-screen politics with people watching the impeachment debate in the House on one side and the missiles striking on the other. And similar questions were raised then by Republicans like Trent Lott, who asked questions about the timing.
Well, President Clinton actually addressed the nation from the Oval Office on December 16, 1998, hours after missiles struck Iraqi military sites and 3 days before the House voted to impeach him. And he brought up impeachment. Take a listen.
Saddam Hussein and the other enemies of peace may have thought that the serious debate currently before the House of Representatives would distract Americans or weaken our resolve to face him down. But once more, the United States has proven that although we are never eager to use force, when we must act in America's vital interests, we will do so.
Boy, it's interesting to hear that today in the context of what's going on now, Julian.
Absolutely. I mean, first, just hearing him call this a serious debate or discussion going on is very different in terms of demeanor than President Trump, who's dismissed the impeachment discussions altogether. But it again, was a moment when President Clinton decided he would try to govern, as he had done before the impeachment started, to demonstrate what American democracy is about, and also to demonstrate that he still was president despite what was going on. Very different than what we're seeing from President Trump and his Twitter feed these days.
Julian, I want to ask you about the U.S. relationship with Iraq in the context of history. The U.S. invaded in 2003, formally withdrew troops in 2011, but thousands of coalition troops remain in an advisory capacity. They've now been asked by the Iraqi parliament to leave Iraq after all these years. What would that mean? And did we get anything out of our involvement there after all these years?
I think the news is it's pretty devastating as an ending. In 2003, when President Bush started the military operations that would bring down Hussein, there were promises that Iraq would be a beacon of democracy and stability in the region, that it would be a long-term ally for the U.S. from that moment forward. But that's not what happened. We ended up in a war that had huge human and financial costs. There's been continued instability surrounding Iraq and the entire area. And now we leave in some ways with our heads down. It's not quite the U.S. fleeing Saigon in 1975, but I think there's a little bit of that feeling.
And what about the relationship between the U.S. and Iran? This has been an uneasy relationship, to say the least, over the past many decades. But how did we get here to the brink of war?
Well, you go all the way back to 1953 when the U.S. and the CIA orchestrated a coup to get rid of the government that was in place, Fast forward to 1979, when there's a revolution in Iran, and American hostages are taken captive and held until 1981. And then moving forward to the tensions that have existed really for the last decade with the new Iranian regime. And there's been different approaches. President Obama tried to negotiate an agreement to contain Iran, and now we've moved toward a more military posture in dealing with the situation. But clearly, right now, this is about as bad as it's been for over a decade.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Julian, just briefly. President Lincoln famously had a team of rivals in his cabinet to advise him. When you look at the people advising President Trump, it's not that.
No, it's an unstable team of yes men. All the moderate, slight skeptics are out. All that remain are people who generally agree or support whatever the president says. And what's most different is you have a president who doesn't have much policy knowledge, who's not committed to traditional forms of governance, and who acts impulsively. So you have people surrounding him as he does all this saying yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's why people are uneasy about what comes next.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Over just 1 year, from 2018 to 2019, more than 200,000 people moved out of California. This rapid decline in population could actually put the state at risk of losing a congressional seat. The mitigation of these population losses, however, could all rest on the final 2020 census count. And ground zero for the count is the city of Los Angeles, where almost every demographic group is represented. Joining us for more is KPCC's executive editor, Megan Garvey. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Megan, as I mentioned, early census estimates show that we've seen a dip in population here, but there are also parts of California that have been historically undercounted. So in addition to the loss of a congressional seat, which would actually be the first time in state history, what else does California stand to lose?
Well, you know, it comes down to not only political power, but really a massive amount of federal money. All told, there's nearly $900 billion that gets distributed nationwide based on the census count. So an undercount in LA could mean that we would not have as much money for some really key programs that help people make ends meet.
The Trump administration made a big push to add the citizenship question to the census. That did not happen, but there still seems to be a lot of fear and distrust. You and your team at KPCC have been working with ethnic media and other community organizations to help quell misinformation around the census. What have you learned so far?
So when we went out and asked people, you know, what they knew about the census, what we found was across a whole range of different types of people, from someone who, you know, was maybe in the country without documentation to someone with a number of postdoctorate, you know, sort of educational degrees, they all had equally little really knowledge about what the census was for, which was pretty interesting to us. And that meant that, you know, there were a large number of groups that are at risk for undercount. And the reality is that all of those groups live in the city of L.A. and in L.A. County. So that's why L.A. County is considered to be the most likely place in the entire United States to see an undercount when it comes to this coming census.
When you talk about some of those populations that we may not think about, what are you talking about?
Well, households without broadband internet. This is the first largely digitally based census. And even though we live in a huge metropolitan area, we have a high number of households that don't have access to broadband internet. We're talking about people who live with roommates who aren't family. In LA, where it's so expensive to live, that's a very common occurrence. We're talking about crowded multi-generational households. That's also very, very common here. Immigrants, foreign-born people, very common here. Adults who are not high school graduates, low-income households, people who are unemployed. And interestingly enough, children under five are often chronically undercounted for a whole range of reasons.
Give me one reason why. When parents talk with census takers, are they just not giving them the numbers there on the children and their families?
Yeah, I think when you talk about who's in your household, interestingly enough, people might not immediately think about children, although they're supposed to. The other thing that we see happen is we see an overcount of white children and an undercount of non-white children. There's a couple reasons for that. often children of divorce get counted twice. They get counted in each household. Hmm. And that tends more often to happen with white children. And the other thing that happens is, on occasion, there might be fear around reporting the actual number of people in your household. Let's say you rented when you were a couple, and now you have three children, and you maybe never told your landlord how many people are living in your apartment. Even though that information is not supposed to be shared, and in fact there's laws prohibiting the sharing of that information, there's a fear on the part of the person filling out the survey who might be concerned that they're jeopardizing their home if they're truthful.
There's so many things to consider here. How are census takers actually interacting then with folks in these different ways to get them to really open up to them and tell them the true reflection of their households?
Well, I think that that work has fallen to a large degree on advocacy groups. And California is spending tens of millions of dollars for outreach. So I think that the outreach is taking part on the ground to try to encourage people to understand all the different ways that the census affects their lives that they may not think about. And you're absolutely right. Just the fact that a citizenship question got considered and talked about, when we went out and talked to people, that's often their main takeaway. When you ask them about the census, they bring up the citizenship question. So that is what they heard about the census, which, of course, it's not even going to be on the census. And, you know, it's not really the point of the census. The census is just supposed to figure out how many people are living in any given place within the United States at that moment in time.
It really comes down to trust, even if people are told that there is no citizenship question.
Well, and, you know, the reality is there is a history with the census that is very troubling and problematic. When Japanese people of Japanese descent were rounded up on the West Coast during World War II, they did use census information in order to target neighborhoods where there was a likelihood of being a lot of Japanese and Japanese Americans. That's a sad legacy that the Census Bureau has admitted to and apologized for. Now, since then, the laws have been changed and they've been tightened, and so that shouldn't happen again. But when people are worried, it's not dislocated from reality, some of those concerns.
That's KPCC's executive editor, Megan Garvey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Pier 1 Imports, the retail furniture company, could be on its way to bankruptcy. The company announced this week it is planning to close about half of its more than 900 stores. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So 450 store closures sounds like a lot. Why is Pier 1 in such trouble?
Well, you know, it's just in the space that a lot of retailers are in, and that they have moved, consumers have moved in a lot of ways to online shopping. And furniture and housing, you know, house stuff was sort of later to this game, but now you've got Walmart in that game, you've got Target in it, you've got Wayfair, places that you can do all of your shopping online. And that's not somewhere that Pier 1 has succeeded as much as. So it's in a lot of trouble. It's gaining a lot of debt. It has been seeing declining sales for the last six or eight quarters. It now needs to get some cash on its hands before it gets into the position where it has to restructure and declare bankruptcy. So it's trying to sort of stave that off.
And trying to stave that off is the end game for Pier 1, which, by the way, started as a single store in San Mateo, California in 1962, went public in the 70s. Is the idea that it would go out of business, get bought by another company, or bounce back and grow again?
It appears that it's trying to bounce back and make a bigger shift into online. Obviously, getting bought by another company is a possibility. You know, Pier 1 was always based on its curated nature of what it bought. It was like going into a place where you were shopping for stuff from around the world, which was really a neat concept until you could buy all of it online and a lot cheaper. and a lot of analysts who are studying it say it's not all that likely that the company is going to be able to turn things around in time to pay its debts, which are maturing fairly soon. So what you might see is it going into a bankruptcy, which will allow it to either restructure or put it on the market for someone to buy it. But for the moment, the company seems to be implying it would like to turn things around, you know, reestablish itself and maybe grow at a slower rate with a little bit more of an online presence.
Now, it imports a lot of stuff from Asia. Yeah. Is the trade war any part of what's going on?
It's not the main factor. It does contribute to some of it, but the problems that Pier 1 has had have preceded the trade war. It's really just having a problem in terms of its business structure. And we're seeing that a lot, right? We saw a lot of companies go from being bricks and mortar stores to online stores. We saw a lot of online only stores establishing some bricks and mortar places like Bonobos or the place where you can buy your glasses. I'm forgetting.
Warby Parker.
And everybody's trying to find what the middle space is for that. And Pier 1 just hasn't been as successful at it. So it's not really the trade war, but the trade war isn't helping.
You know, I don't even wear glasses, but I think they look cool from Warby Parker.
They do, right?
Yeah.
They've succeeded.
Okay. One more question, Ali. And this is because, you know, the market's been doing so well for so long, everybody's kind of on edge, wondering if the next shoe to drop is going to lead to a recession. Is what's happening with Pier 1 a part of a bigger trend? Do you think other retailers are going to start closing their doors too?
It is part of a bigger trend, but it's not a recessionary trend. It's an online trend. In 2019, there were 9,000 store closings in the United States. That's a 59% jump from 2018. And I always bring this up because President Trump always talks about saving the coal industry. Mm-hmm. We've lost many, many times the entire population of the coal industry in retail. So bricks and mortar retail is probably the worst industry to be in right now. That's what this is part of a larger trend about.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
President Trump ordered the drone strike that killed Qasem Soleimani while he was at his Florida resort Mar-a-Lago for the holidays. Just days before the strike, he was spotted in the buffet line chatting with Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor who could join Trump's legal team for the impeachment trial. Dershowitz has said the president did not commit an impeachable offense. Alan Dershowitz joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start with Iran because you were at Mar-a-Lago on Christmas Eve, a few days before the attack that killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Did you discuss Iran with President Trump?
No, we just exchanged holiday greetings and our families met. I was there with another couple. I was their guest and I just ran into the president on the buffet line and we didn't really talk any substance, certainly never mentioned Iran. That's not something he would confide in me if he was planning to do an attack like this. I don't even have security clearance.
Well, I was just asking because you did write a book in 2015 called The Case Against the Iran Deal.
I also wrote a book called Preemption. So I am an expert on the use of targeted killings and a strong supporter of targeted killings of terrorists in ongoing terrorist situations. But it's not something the president discussed with me. I wrote a piece for The Wall Street Journal yesterday, and I've been talking about what I believe is the strong case for the legality. I don't take a position particularly on the long-term wisdom of the action, but I think the legality is not even a close question. I think it was more legal, if anything, than the killing of Osama bin Laden, because the Osama bin Laden killing was not preventive. It was vengeance. It was getting even with a massive criminal. That was justified, but it was justified on different grounds. The Soleimani case is a much stronger case for preemptive or preventive targeted killing.
Do you think that it was the right move? Do you think that President Trump made the right decision by ordering the killing of Soleimani?
I think that's reasonable. People could disagree about that, but I don't think anybody should conflate the policy arguments with the legal arguments, and many people do that. Something could be illegal and good policy, and something could be legal and bad policy. In this case, it was clearly legal under both international law and American constitutional law. And the question of whether it's good policy, only time will tell.
There are reports that President Trump is considering adding you to his impeachment legal team. Is that true?
Right. The reports are true, but I can't comment about whether or not I've agreed to join his legal team. But there has been some discussion of that.
You do believe that there's been no crime committed by the president. Is that right?
I believe there's been no impeachable offense. I think that both of the articles of impeachment violate the Constitution. Abuse of power is something that's been a charge against every president since John Adams, and the framers explicitly rejected broad criteria for impeachment, such as maladministration, and I think included with that would be abuse of power. The second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, is just completely made up. President A didn't obstruct Congress by simply demanding that there be court orders before subpoenas are complied with, and one can argue that the Speaker of the House is obstructing the Senate by not sending the articles of impeachment. I don't think those kinds of metaphorical accusations should rise to the level of impeachment, and I don't think they do as a matter of constitutional law. And I've said the same thing going back to the impeachment of Nixon, the impeachment of Clinton. I've been very opposed to impeachment from the 1970s. I was on the national board of the ACLU, and I opposed the ACLU seeking the impeachment of Richard Nixon, even though I personally favored the impeachment of Nixon. I thought they should be there defending his constitutional rights and opposing his being named as an unindicted co-conspirator, which doesn't give anybody the opportunity to prove their innocence. So I put civil liberties before impeachment, unlike the ACLU, which puts politics before civil liberties.
But impeachment is in the Constitution. What's wrong with it?
Nothing's wrong with impeachment. I support impeachment being in the Constitution. I think the criteria for impeachment have to be satisfied. There were two debates at the Constitutional Convention. One, should there be impeachment of a president at all? Madison strongly supported that. And then, what should the criteria be? And Madison demanded that the criteria be quite rigid. He rejected maladministration. He said he didn't want to turn the United States into a British-type parliament where a president serves at the will of Congress or at the legislature, and you can simply have a vote of no confidence. So he was very tough on what the criteria ought to be, and the criteria simply aren't met. So I'm not opposed to impeachment, but I strongly oppose impeachment on grounds like obstruction of Congress or abuse of power. Those are not in the Constitution, and the framers would never have accepted that in the Constitution.
Well, when it comes to the impeachment of President Trump, as you know, your colleague Noah Feldman at Harvard disagrees. So does law professor Michael Gerhard, who testified before the House Judiciary Committee in December. Let's listen.
If what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. This is precisely the misconduct that the framers created a Constitution, including impeachment, to protect against.
How do you respond to that, Alan Dershowitz?
Well, he's confusing the debate over whether we should have impeachment. He's right that this is the kind of conduct that the framers said requires that we have an ability to impeach a president. But when the second part of the debate came about, what should the criteria be, everything changed. And Madison was very determined to make sure that the criteria did not include a material like this. Look, I don't believe that my colleagues passed the shoe on the other foot test. I don't believe that if Hillary Clinton had been elected president and she were being impeached for the emails or whatever, I do not believe my colleagues would be favoring impeachment. I think they have put politics before constitutionality.
Do you think that the Senate trial should proceed as soon as possible?
I do. I think that removal and impeachment are part of the same process, and it would be unconstitutional for the House to impeach and refuse to send the articles. It's all part and parcel. It would be like a prosecutor saying, look, I'll never get a jury to convict this guy. Let's indict him. Let's have the indictment hang over his head for the rest of his life, but we'll never bring him to trial. I believe the articles of impeachment will be sent, and there will be a trial. What the nature of the trial is will obviously be up to the Senate.
Would you favor witnesses, including John Bolton, who says he's willing to testify if subpoenaed?
I don't think you get to witnesses unless the allegations satisfy the Constitution. And so I suspect that what's going to happen is before you get to the issue of facts, the Senate will have to decide whether or not these articles of impeachment rise to the level of impeachable offenses. I do not believe they do.
Alan Dershowitz, I have to ask you about one more thing since you've been in the news and you've got a new book out called Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of Me Too. You've been accused by a woman who says that you sexually assaulted her when she was a teenager, when she was with Jeffrey Epstein. You're now countersuing her, saying her accusations are false and defamatory. And you say that you can prove that she made the whole thing up. Have you been able to come up with the evidence to do that?
Oh, absolutely. I have her emails in which she admits she never met me. This is the only Me Too case in which the accuser never met the accused. She is a person with a long, long history of lying, and I have her emails, and I have a tape recording by her own lawyer, her agent, in which the lawyer says she's wrong, simply wrong. It would have been impossible for you to have been in the places she said she met you. He didn't know he was being recorded when he made that admission to me, but that admission on tape is going to be very, very important at trial. This is not a story about whether a person consented or whether there was harassment. This is a story of a woman who, from the beginning, made it up out of whole cloth in order to earn money. This is a woman who, if her lawyers encouraged her to tell a false story or to be disbarred, all of this will come out at the trial. And if it's proved that there was extortion and there was subornation of perjury, there have to be consequences. You know, the problem in our country is you can make a false accusation under oath and nobody gets indicted for perjury. In other countries, people who make false accusations are indicted for perjury. And I want to change the law to make sure the woman who falsely accused me is prosecuted for perjury. I've asked the FBI to come to the trial to listen to both of our testimony because one of us is committing perjury. And it's clearly not me. I have the absolute proof that I'm telling the truth and she made up the whole story. So I'm looking forward to the trial.
And what about Jeffrey Epstein? Were you unaware of all the things that he's been accused of?
Oh, of course. And Larry Summers was unaware of it. And David Gergen was unaware of it. All the people who knew Jeffrey Epstein in an academic capacity and went to conferences at Harvard, as I did, none of us had any inkling that he was doing anything wrong. I first learned of any of these allegations when he asked me to be his lawyer. I then served as his lawyer in a professional capacity. I did absolutely nothing wrong in relation to Jeffrey Epstein. Zero, nothing. I never had any personal friendship with him after the allegations came out. Look, since the day I met Jeffrey Epstein, I've had sex with one woman, my wife, period. And any allegation to the contrary is totally and completely false.
That is Alan Dershowitz, defense attorney and Harvard law professor, whose new book is called Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of Me Too. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Twenty firefighters from California are headed to Australia to help exhausted firefighters there get a grip on the massive outbreak of fires that have ravaged parts of the continent. At least 25 people have died. Thousands are homeless. Millions of acres have burned. And about 24 people have been charged with arson. We're joined now by Angeles National Forest Fire Chief Robert Garcia, who is overseeing this group of California volunteers on this global firefighting effort. Welcome, Chief.
Oh, yes. Hello.
So about 100 firefighters throughout the United States have traveled over the last month to assist in this ongoing battle. And your team is especially adept. Many of them were part of the firefighting efforts of the Saddle Ridge fire last October. Tell me more about the team that's there right now.
Oh, that's correct. They are all local members from the local unit here on the Angeles National Forest. They come from a number of different modules, as we call them, or crew types, meaning some of them come off of engine crews, hotshot crews, heli-tac crews, and other positions. They are all very experienced. The group is comprised of personnel from different levels of the organization, meaning different rank positions. And they are all highly skilled and highly experienced fighting fire across the United States, particularly here in Southern California.
This was in many ways a return of a favor. Australian firefighters had come to California to assist as well, correct?
That's correct. We've maintained this international exchange with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Interior for many years. About 15 years ago in California is when we saw the Australians assisting us here locally and more recent years throughout the country and fires throughout the United States. So our firefighters have worked alongside with firefighters from other countries for many years.
Where in Australia will your team be stationed and how will they be assisting?
They arrived actually early this morning in Melbourne. They'll receive a briefing there to get kind of oriented to the situation at hand, as well as kind of the lay of the land, if you will, the organizational structure. And then they'll get some orientation on the specialty tools and equipment and apparatus that they'll be assigned to. So they'll get at least a day or two of orientation and some rapid training and team building with the unit they'll be assigned with. And at that point, situation will kind of dictate where they get specifically deployed to.
One of the most striking things about these fires in Australia is that they're expected to burn for months. How long is your team planning to stay there? And do you envision more crews from California going there to assist?
This particular group will be deploying for 35 days. This is a part of a national effort out of the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, which is a collaboration between the United States Forest Service and the Department of Interior agencies, Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, as a national coordinated effort. So they would make the request to any local units such as the Angeles to fill specific needs.
Your team, they're professionals. They've been at this for a long time as well. They probably were eager to go over there to assist the folks in Australia. But I can imagine their family and friends were also probably feeling a little bit perhaps concerned while also proud that they're headed there. Did your guys talk at all about that before they left?
Just as you described, quite a mix of emotions. There's excitement to go to a new place and a lot of uncertainty. You know, obviously a 30-day type of assignment is a long time to be away from home, family, friends, things like that. So, there's a tremendous mix of emotions. People were selected for this assignment are honored to be able to go and assist. And so it's just, just an interesting time for them as they kind of deal with trying to prepare the best they can, try to prepare and leave their family with peace of mind and do their best to represent the United States and the U.S. Forest Service.
You've been at this for a long time. As you mentioned, we've had devastating fires here in California. As you look across to what's happening in Australia, I just know your heart has to go out to them.
Yeah, it's definitely a part of the equation here. We spent some time looking at the technical aspects of what our crews will be facing and, the organizational things there, the terrain, fuels, topography. But there's also been a tremendous amount of focus from our firefighters and from us here supporting them on really what the Australians are going through. The impact of wildfire is far more reaching than those imminently impacted, whether it's structures, but how it impacts society, whether it's transportation routes, whether it's water storage, the toll on wildlife, just a major disruption to the way of life, and it's something we see here in Southern California, but throughout the Western United States as wildfire. The intensity of fire season, it's got a far more reaching impact than just those directly involved.
That's the Angeles National Forest Fire Chief, Robert Garcia, who is overseeing a group of California volunteers in Australia to assist in firefighting efforts. Chief, thank you for your time.
Thank you. And our thoughts and prayers are with the people of Australia.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.